Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This is the second of two conversations with Jerry DeWitt, author of Hope After Faith, an ex-pastor's journey from belief to atheism. In our first visit, available online at radiocurious.org/DeWitt, Jerry DeWitt talks about his childhood experiences that led him to be a fundamentalist Pentecostal preacher. His website, Hope After Faith, is an interesting source with links to the curious conundrums fomented by religion. In this conversation, recorded by phone from Western Florida on December 13, 2013, we begin with Jerry DeWitt's process of coming out as an atheist after 25 years as a fundamentalist Pentecostal preacher.
I wish there were simple answers. Obviously, this took 25 years of my life, and so there's a lot of little moments, a lot of little details that add up to what now appears to be a major, you know, in most people's view, a major left-handed turn. But to me, I feel like I'm still the exact same person I always was. And what I was looking for was the reality of God. I believed as a very early, you know, very young minister that that there must be a way to bring God's reality into our lives, that God could be just as real in your life as your spouse is physically, could physically be real in your life as well. And so I had a love for God. I loved God so much that I was looking for that way of having God be that real in my life. The other part of this picture is that I loved humanity. I loved people, and that was my primary draw to the ministry. Now, I can see it looking back that I was wanting to serve humanity. I was wanting to ease human suffering. And so, in the very beginning, the first wave of those efforts was through very hardcore Pentecostalism, and I was trying to serve humanity by saving them from hell. And I was trying to know God better through living a life of dedication, of poverty, of fasting, of prayer, of spiritual gifts. And then as time went on, I would move out of that, and I would move towards, I would no longer believe in hell. I would no longer believe that the Christian doctrine was originally meant to be founded on a fear of hell. And I would see hell as simply as death, as the grave. And I would then begin to look at a doctrine that was more all inclusive. You know, actually, Bishop Carlton Pearson had a huge influence in my life, and because he teaches the gospel of inclusion. And so I then began to preach a message of inclusion, thinking that by no longer alienating different types of people, that we would lessen human suffering in that way. And that was, I would then draw closer to God in the fact that I would become a conduit of God's love. I had given up on the idea of trying to, you know, get God to ride in the car with me physically, and instead I would be the vehicle that God would ride through in the world and demonstrate his love.
In becoming the vehicle, can you describe markers along the way that you passed in your journey where you had a realization that there's a new point of view here?
Sure. A major turning point was in Des Moines, Iowa. I had followed this desire to know God more personally and to save people from the concept that I had at the time of hell. I had followed that vision 1,000 miles from my home in DeRidder, Louisiana. I had taken my family to Des Moines, Iowa, and was sitting under a minister by the name of Lloyd Goodwin. And it seemed as if he had all the answers to all of these complicated questions that were developing as I was going through this journey. And in discovering that he did not, in discovering that there may not be any clear answers to some of these questions, that there may be conflicts within the Bible itself that are unresolvable, that was a major landmark for me. Suddenly now, the answer was not finding the right tree, chopping it down, and counting the rings and knowing the answer. The answer was no longer knowing the answer. The answer was trying to find a way to deal with the fact that there was a question you might not know the answer to. And so that was a major landmark in my life, that I had to give up on this idea of nailing down all the answers.
You characterize the role of religion to provide answers through the medium of the pastor.
Right.
And you characterize atheism how?
Well, this would be what I would encourage people to do, whether they're atheist or not. First off, I would encourage people to try to find a way to enjoy and embrace the questions and not feel quite so desperate to always find the answers. Obviously, looking for answers has led to our great scientific discoveries, and so I'm all for that. But at the same time, I think it's wise to realize just how incredibly complicated the human experience in particular is. So where one time there was a pastor, there was a man of God in our worldview that had a direct connection with the divine and was able to supply all these answers, and we would sit at his feet and look for those answers through an individual, I think we should first embrace mystery, and second, that we should look for answers when we really have to have a real answer, look for it through the scientific method, and if it's something that seems to be outside of that realm, then it's okay. It's okay to not know everything. And in the past, it wasn't okay to not know everything. And when you ran into that wall that you realized you were not going to know the answer, well, then that's where faith stepped in, and you literally just shut your mind off from that. And I think that's equally as dangerous. I think there's a way to enjoy the mystery while trying to get to the answers.
When you say in the past, that's your personal past.
That's right. That's my very particular experience. That's correct.
So going back to early in your relationship with your wife, Kelly, before your son Paul was born, you describe a love triangle that would characterize your life with Kelly, which was between you and her, in your ministry, and then you say, to be honest, perhaps a fourth party, your own ego.
Yeah.
In retrospect, what role has your ego played in the transition from Christianity to atheism?
That is a very good question. I think it's had a very predominant role. And the reason that I think that it has is because I truly felt like I was called to do something special when I was a Christian. I really felt like that I was to be gifted in a way that I would deliver a very unique message, a message maybe that was fitting for our times. I really thought that I was not just called, but also obligated to do something. That's the egotism that I refer back to, that I thought I was as special, for sure, as all of the other prominent ministers in my life, and possibly even more special than them, more destined for something greater or bigger. And so I felt like it was worth the sacrifice. There was a lot of sacrifice came from studying the things that I studied and venturing out into the new territories that I ventured into, because every time I would go into a new territory, that would destroy the foundations of success that I had built in the previous. You know, whether that was financial success or whether that was social success, all of that would kind of, you know, drift away as I went into a new adventure. So we were constantly starting over, but I felt like that was a necessary price to pay to get to the ultimate goal of doing something very, very important.
When you speak of sacrifice, what were those sacrifices?
first sacrifice that comes to my mind is losing time with my son. Having my mind so preoccupied with the quest, if you will, that even whenever I was in the presence of my son, my mind was completely distracted. And so the quality time that I would have spent with my son is the greatest sacrifice that I feel like that we made. The next would be a very similar situation with my wife. My wife was always put, she probably wasn't even put second. She was probably put third or fourth in the list of priorities in life. And so she suffered financially. She suffered with a lack of security, you know, because we were always living on the edge. We were always living in poverty. We were always, you know, tearing up the old life and starting a new life. And that was a great sacrifice that she made. And obviously, at the moment, I was being fulfilled by fulfilling this quest. But at the same time, I sensed loneliness. I could tell that there was more to be gotten out of our relationship. There was more to be had. But I just dealt with that loneliness, and I dealt with that loss, and moved on for the sake of the quest. And so, looking back on it now, it seems like a huge sacrifice. And we sacrificed a lot of our social standing long before I would be outed as an atheist. As I would move from hardcore Pentecostalism to something more liberal than everyone in the old school, old hardcore Pentecostalism school, would look down on us because we had moved, we had changed our worldview. And so religious rejection is nothing new for us, but there were lots of sacrifices.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting in our second conversation with Jerry DeWitt, a pastor who has journeyed from belief to atheism. He's the author of Hope After Faith. You are listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jerry, the elements of similarity between religion and politics, do you see them affecting your journey from Christianity to atheism?
Sure. I certainly do. You know, the thing that religion or religious institutions, religious influence and political influence share is the ability to control, the ability to sway a mass of people. And it just so happens that, you know, my faith journey started during a time that the political landscape was becoming more and more conservative, more and more evangelical.
To what year do you refer when you say that?
Well, I got saved at Jimmy Swaggart's church in 1986. And so, you know, we're heading into the Reagan era. And so you've got the very strong influences of the Jerry Falwells, you know, of the Christian right that are influencing U.S. politics, which in turn then influences what you hear coming from the pulpits, out of the churches, and the whole thing takes a real swing towards something more conservative than what it was previously, and it's that conservatism, that evangelical way of looking at Christian doctrine that gives the promise of something more and insist upon you finding the answer and getting to the bottom of things and finding a method of success through God's blessings. And obviously that's still extremely, extremely prevalent, in the marketplace of ideas even now, even though it obviously has not been successful, that's still being sold.
It seems to be extremely prevalent from some perspectives in the Congress of the United States.
Absolutely. It surely is. And so it does two things. As a young man, you know, I remember when I went and I registered to vote. And I came home, and my grandfather, who I talk about in the book, He asked me how I, you know, what I registered, you know, what I register as, and I said as a Republican. And of course, you know, there was influence. You know, that's who was in power at the time. That's what I was accustomed to. And he was so disappointed, and he couldn't believe it. And he said, a Republican? He said, the Republicans are for the rich, you know, and it was obvious that we weren't. And I was trying to be quick on my feet and at the same time be respectful to him. And I said, well, I plan on being rich one day, so I might as well get in with them while I can, you know. And so that conservative religious political, you know, overwash that I was introduced to, it does two things. Number one, because that's what's in power, because that's the norm, it causes you to not be as inclined to question it, because obviously that's what's right, because that's what everybody's accepting as the way of looking at life and looking at religion. And the second thing that particular conservative view, evangelical political view does is it does make some really strong promises. And it sets the participant up for a trap, because the promise is that if you follow the program, then you will fulfill the American dream. Being saved and fulfilling the American dream have become the same thing. And so I think it sets people up for failure, because these huge promises are made. You have the Joel Osteens of the world that are standing there in their tailored suits with their perfect teeth and their beautiful hair in front of, you know, 20,000 people. And basically what they're saying to the single mom sitting there in abject poverty is that if this person will pay their tithes and be faithful, read their Bible, buy his next book, that they too will one day stand on a stage with perfect hair and beautiful teeth. And that sets people up for failure. But the trap is, if that doesn't happen for that single mom, then the dark side, the backside of this type of theology is that somehow it's her fault. Somehow she didn't believe enough, she wasn't faithful enough, there's something she did wrong, or she would also be living the American dream as well. And that was the world that I started off in. That was the world that I saw. Had I not been brought up in that world, then I might have looked at Christianity completely differently and not asked the questions that I was forced to ask, and might have went a total different direction.
And now you have rejected Christianity, crossed the line, if there is a line, into atheism. You're shunned by some people in your home community of DeRidder, Louisiana, yet you refuse to describe your embrace of atheism as a loss of faith.
Right. That's right, yeah. I wouldn't even say that I've rejected Christianity. The way that I look at it, it's as if you grow up in a home, and the stories that you're told is that somewhere hidden in this large home, is a fabulous treasure. You don't really know what it looks like, but you know that it's extremely, extremely valuable. And then later on in life, the home becomes yours. You inherit the home. And you're so desperate to find this treasure that you take the home apart board by board. And over the course of 25 years, you literally take the home down to the very ground itself. And one day, you just look up and realize there's no home left. And for a brief moment, you are you're overcome by disappointment that there's no home left and there's no treasure found. But once the structure is completely out of view, you're able to look around at the beauty of nature itself and realize that was the treasure all along and that you have finally found it. Does that mean you rejected the home? Absolutely not. You tore it apart because you were looking for the treasure that was promised. And that's the way I feel. I feel like I'm the same person that I was when I was 17 years old and I was trying to find the treasure through prayer and fasting and the gifts of the Spirit and so forth.
Have you now found the treasure?
Absolutely.
Can you describe it for us?
I have. And the treasure is the gift of simply being alive and experiencing this universe. That's the treasure. Because it so easily could have not happened.
In characterizing yourself as a free-thinking humanist, as you do in your book, Hope After Faith, how would you present this treasure?
That is the issue, isn't it? Religion, you know, has thousands of years of practice, of experience, of creating literature, creating art, creating a vocabulary that clearly expresses their own worldview and their sense of awe of the divine. And I think we're struggling to do that ourselves. I think as humanists, we're trying to develop our own vocabulary, develop our own mediums that we can use to express the sense of awe that we feel on the inside. We're just struggling to get it out and communicate it to the next person. But I think some of this we do naturally, but we just overlook it. Whether we're a believer or a non-believer, we know that there's a value in the relationships that we have with our loved ones. Now, we may sacrifice it for not just our religious views, but our ambitions, for a lot of other things. But even when we're sacrificing it, we call it a sacrifice because we know that it has great value. So I think instinctively, as human beings, we know where the value's at. We know where the beauty's at. There's a reason we want to go to the beach for vacation. There's a reason we want to go to the snow-capped mountains for vacation. As human beings, we instinctively know that there is a beauty in nature. There is a beauty in being alive, experiencing the existence of being alive, and of communicating with our loved ones. So all that's left now is to take advantage of those innate values and find our non-religious language to express that communication.
That's what I'm looking for. That's my question to you, Jerry DeWitt.
Yeah.
in the era of new words, as we have all experienced since computers have become a part of many people's lives, what are the new words or the new memes that you would use to define or to summarize what you have just said?
You know, I would have to really think about that to see if there are any new words. What I'm struggling to do is I think I'm struggling to use some of my old language in new settings in a way that that people can understand and hopefully not create too much confusion.
Tell us in your own words.
Well, I know that we still use the word inspiration, obviously.
Well, Jerry DeWitt, author of Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Belief to Atheism, thanks again for being with us in two parts of Radio Curious. And going back to the three questions I like to ask everyone, when in part one you were telling us about an aha moment, you told me that there's more to it, perhaps other aha moments. What would another
right.
be?
To finish up that aha moment that I think is important, up until this very, you know, up until that moment, I felt as if I was responsible for my own salvation. When I realized I could not be, I literally stood at the back of our, at the time we lived in a single wide mobile home, I stood at the back door and it was slammed open by a great gust of wind because there was a very, very ugly storm coming from the north, coming straight for us. When that door crashed against the side of the metal mobile home, I looked at that storm and in my mind it became a representation of God, and I was speaking out to God, and I simply said, I can't save myself. I can't save myself. I can't live right enough to do this. If I'm going to be saved, it's completely and totally up to you. And that's what most people would consider to be a true salvation experience, which would make them discredit all the years I spent before then. But what it did for me, that aha moment, was me realizing that there really was a lot of life and a lot of situations that were completely out of my control, and that I had to find a way to adapt that. Up until that moment, I was trying to make the world adapt to me. But from there on, slowly through very small increments, I would learn that I would have to adapt to what reality was. And I think that set a course for the rest of my life.
And then it's the rest of your life question. What would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life, in addition, as you have told us, to spend time with your wife and your son?
I would like to learn about me. I would like to try to step almost back in time before I became so indoctrinated, particularly at age 17, and see if I can somehow mine out of myself what my true tastes are. What do I really naturally appreciate versus what I was taught to appreciate? I really would like to spend the rest of my life becoming more me.
And finally, Jerry DeWitt, in addition to the books by Joseph Campbell that you recommended in our first conversation, are there other books that you would recommend to our listeners?
I think so. If a person is just making their way in their spiritual journey, I think Bishop Carlton Pearson, Mike Williams. If they're a little bit further along, obviously, I think if they pick up anything by Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, my friend Dan Barker. Matter of fact, I just finished Richard Dawkins' An Appetite for Wonder. I think those are important because they're going to show you the human side of these renowned non-believers. So those are important, I think.
Jerry DeWitt, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure.
Jerry DeWitt is a former fundamentalist Pentecostal preacher who came out as an atheist. He's the author of Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Belief to Atheism. The books he recommends are those that show the human side of renowned non-believers, written by Richard Dawkins, Carlton Pearson, Michael Williams, Dan Barker, and or Daniel Dennett. Our two visits with Jerry DeWitt were recorded on December 13, 2013. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org. And I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.